smaller bills first before we get back into 3394. Since Senator Fisher is here, I want to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 497 and start off with Senator Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Senator Bill Fisher from District 23 down in Roseburg and Flint South. This is a relatively simple bill that's had a rather difficult legislative history. Back in the early 90s, the Umpqua, South Umpqua State Bank bought a Aquatech truck. It's a truck that back flushes the sewer lines in the cities. They bought this particular piece of machinery and leased it to the Roseburg Urban Sanitary District. The Roseburg Urban Sanitary District forgot to fill out the proper papers to get the property tax exemption for that truck. And we had an assessor that was very assiduous in her work, and she assessed them the fee for it. They got the paperwork straightened out, but were never able to reach an agreement. The assessor claimed that she could not forgive the tax. RUSA said they wouldn't pay it, and we had a little local standoff there for some time, and it came to a legislative session, and I asked LC to draft up a bill that would take care of it, and they put the wrong paragraph in the bill. It was a paragraph that leased from government to government agency, and this was a private group to a public agency, which was the paragraph following, and it wasn't caught. So we passed the bill, and it didn't do the job, and the assessor didn't take it in good faith and claimed they still owed her the money. This went on, and 2 years later, I took the bill to her and got her to make sure that the language was proper and worked it through the Senate, and it died in the House Committee. And so we're back again in 1997 for the third time on this bill. We have the wording right that met the specifications of the assessor. The assessor is no longer there. We have a new assessor. The bank finally was coerced, and I didn't really realize that. It just happened this last fall, shortly before we got here to the legislature. And so the bank has actually paid the taxes and interest because ultimately when RUSA refused, apparently the assessor's office took after the bank and the bank has paid it, but the money needs to be returned. It was not necessary to pay that assessment fee in the first place. So I would request that you give me a little bit of help to get this thing through, and we don't have to face it in 2001.
Hey, are there any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it very much.
You bet. Tim Maneri?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. I just point out to you one thing about the bill that is, I think, unusual, and that is on line 10, as a condition for this, you have two situations. One is the timeliness of the filing, which is not unusual in some exemption cases. But the second thing that is unusual is that the bill says that even though there was no express agreement within the lease or lease purchase agreement that the rent payable was established to reflect savings below market rent, then you still get the exemption.
Yeah. The law provides that if an exempt organization leases to another exempt, the only condition is that the property be used for the purpose under the exemption. But the law provides that if you have a taxable entity leasing to an exempt, that the condition is that the savings from the exemption be passed through from the taxable any to the exempt one, so that the tax benefit goes to the exempt organization. And the mechanism to do that is to reduce the market rent to reflect the tax savings. That way it's the exempt organization that gets the benefit, not the taxes. This bill does provide that even though the tax benefit is not passed through to the exempt organization, that the exemption is granted anyway. And that's just an unusual thing about this bill. I thought I'd point that out.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Do you have any, yeah, Representative Merkley?
Just wonder if we could have the sponsor of the bill explain why he chose to have that particular provision in here.
This bill was drafted with the, excuse me, Senator Fisher, again, thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley. This bill was coached and drafted by the Douglas County Assessor at her demand that it meet her specifications in order to have the money refunded or the money not charged to the Urban Sanitary District. And I can't tell you why it was in here other than that she was the one that directed the bill and again said she had to have this wording in it. So.
And Gil, do you want to join us and maybe you can help us from the county perspective?
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. The facts as related to me by the Douglas County Assessor's Office are pretty straightforward. The bank owns the truck. They lease it to the authority. The authority for these 2 years in dispute did not apply for the exemption as required by statute and would not have qualified if they had applied because the lease agreement did not reflect the tax savings. The lease agreement was modified and the exemption was filed correctly in April of 1994, and they've qualified for the exemption henceforth. The authority took an appeal, and maybe the bank was involved too, took an appeal to the Department of Revenue on these 2 years of dispute and lost. The bank owner has paid the taxes in May of 98 with interest. Now, what this bill does is it asks you to ignore that the application was not filed for these 2 years as required by statute. Asks you to ignore that for these 2 years, the lease agreement did not reflect the tax savings as required by statute. And to ignore that the appeal was denied by the Department of Revenue and to refund all property taxes with interest for those 2 years. Now, there's some ambiguity in the bill. Line 21 states that any property taxes and interest shall be refunded. However, line 28 says shall be made without interest. So there's a lack of clarity in the bill itself still. Our suggestion is if you insist on passing this bill that it would be appropriate for the taxpayer to pay the normal late filing fee that the other taxpayers would have to pay if they were a few weeks or a few months late. That's in subsection 2 of ORS 307-162, and it provides that the late application must be accompanied by a late filing fee of the greater of $200 or 0.1% of the assessed value of the property. We'd ask that at the very least you apply that to the 2 years that they were late because they were not late by a matter of weeks or months. They were late by a matter of 5 and 6 years.
Mr. Chair.
Jane Merkley.
Senator Fisher, do you have information as to whether the benefits of the tax exemption were passed through in the lease amount for those years, or whether this is simply a straight benefit that will occur back to the bank that owns the truck?
It's my understanding that, and I am not an attorney or an accountant, but it's my understanding that the lease was not predicated on any tax being paid because it would have been a vehicle that was not subject to property tax properly done. And my feeling was that parties, as I understood it, were under that impression. And RUSA absolutely refused to pay when they were billed. And I was unaware when I came here that the bank had picked up the tax. Nobody had ever followed through with me and told me that. And I had worked with Doug, his last name slipped my mind at the moment, who's the manager of RUSA. And we'd agreed that I would put the bill in the hopper again this time, so I, hearing nothing from him as far as the fact of the update on it or anything, I just went ahead and put it back as the assessor had okayed it from before. And again, I'm not unwilling to put in some favorable amendments if we've got a problem in here. As far as the interest and so forth, I'm perfectly willing to be reasonable as far as amendments to that, because I'm not an expert in this and I'm not an attorney to understand all the rules and regulations. As far as the late filing, again, as I said, it was, yes, probably filed late because they would have not thought that they had to file in the first place. And when they didn't fix out the proper papers, there's a new guy. The old manager of RUSA is not around anymore. I don't know what his reasoning was or what his lack of reasoning was to get this whole problem started in the first place. So it's pretty hard. Doug Zener is his last name, the fellow that's there now, and obviously he had an interest in getting this taken care of, and why they went ahead and why the bank paid it, I don't know. But again, I'm not an attorney. I know whether they were forced to do that by attorneys in the process, or whether their attorneys advise them to do it just to get the assessor off their back, or what the case might be. So I apologize for not having answers to those questions, because it happened a long time ago, and we don't have, as I said, we've got a new assessor now that wasn't privy to things back then, and also a new manager for RUSA.
Senator, would you represent with?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jim, what was the basis of the Department of Revenue denying the appeal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I believe it was both on the grounds of the late filing and not having a rent savings provision.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. If it's the rent savings provision, then why was the application for exemption approved for the 94-95 tax year?
Representative Witt, I believe they changed the lease to reflect it.
Including a lower rent?
Yes.
Representative Witt, Mr. Chair. I believe that had they known about that, that they would have certainly modified that lease earlier, too, if they'd understood that that was necessary and that was part of the process. I don't think, from my understanding, the bank and RUSA have ever had any arguments over this thing.
Okay. Senator Fisher, do you think there would be any problem to do an amendment, as Mr. Riddell has suggested, to require the payment of the late filing fee? I think we did that with another similar such request, and that was the sense of the committee at that point, that if we're going to grant a retroactive exemption, at the very least there ought to be the penalty that anybody else who would be filing late and paying would normally pay.
I don't have a problem with that, with the exception of the fact that in this particular instance, I think it was a good faith mistake. I don't think anybody just went out and got to try to not pay it. And from that standpoint, the frustration is that because the proper paper wasn't filled out at the time that this thing took place to begin with, and, to go back and try to me, it's an administrative error on the part of the former manager, who was asleep at the switch as far as I'm concerned, and it's pretty hard to take it out of his hide when I don't even know where he's at anymore, if he's even with us for sure. So,
I appreciate that, but we have done that with other folks who have
unintentionally
made a mistake in filing.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to be hard to deal with.
Mr. Chair? This has been dealt with. I was distracted down here for a bit, but I understand we didn't have the pass-through provision in the leases. How are the tax benefits going to accrue back to the tax-exempt entity?
Who can answer that?
Well, they haven't been paid by the tax entity.
They paid a lease. They paid a full market lease, as I understand. And this is going to give a tax refund, basically, to the owner of the truck, for years in which the sewer or the sanitary district or the sanitary authority paid full market rent, is there anything in this that gets the benefit of that refund back to the tax-exempt entity, or is this just puts money in the pocket of the owner of the truck?
Representative Strobeck, Representative Shirley, this wasn't charged originally to the owners. This was charged to RUSA, and RUSA refused to pay it. In some way or another, it got transferred around and sent back, and the bank took care of it. My guess is the bank probably took care of it rather than arguing about it. My guess is that this was never even figured in the first place into the lease because they didn't think they had to pay it. So I don't think that it was something that that the bank would have charged for and then not passed through the savings. I think the whole thing, as near as I can tell, was just a mistake of omission on the part of RUSA to follow through and get the proper paper signed and maybe change the lease to reflect that, which it probably reflected anyway, but just didn't happen to mention it and say it straight out in the lease.
Mr. But as I understand, the refund in this case will go to the owner of the truck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, that's right, because they paid it in lieu of RUSA payment. When RUSA refused to pay it, they stepped in and paid it for RUSA is what happened, so they would naturally get the refund rather than RUSA.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, President Shirley, answer your question. There's nothing that I read in the bill that would require that any refund reflect tax savings that were incorporated in the lease agreement after April of 94. So it would go back to the old lease. That's how I read the bill anyway.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question?
Sure.
I don't know if we can. He seems to have, I don't have a copy of the lease. I've never been privy to the lease. And was the lease changed, or did the lease just have wording put in it to reflect the fact that it didn't have the tax figured in the first place?
Mr. Chair, Senator Fisher, I'm relating facts that were given to me by Douglas County Assessor's Office, but it sounds like with the appeal denied to the Department of Revenue, the original lease was not merely miswritten, but also did not reflect the tax savings. It was done in April of 94. I've not seen the lease.
Mr. Chair, it's been my observation as a business person that when you lease a vehicle, you lease to somebody and they have the full payment of the tax responsibilities. They're not figured in the lease. And I can't imagine why they would have figured property tax on a lease when there was no intention whatsoever of anybody even beginning to think that they had to pay a tax on that unit. So I think that's a moot question.
Jim? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Lemary. Another solution, which is typically what you do in this case, where you find that maybe there was some confusion over the filing and you want to give them another chance, is to allow them to file the application again with the late filing fee and then let the new assessor determine whether the rent was passed through. If it was, they qualify for the exemption and they can get it. I mean, that's typically your solution. And that way the assessor can sit down with them and look through what happened.
Okay. Well, I think that sounds like at least a possible solution. So rather than going to work session on this today, I'll get those questions answered, see if we can get back to the assessor, and we'll resolve this next time we get it up for the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 97. I want to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 245. We're going to go backwards and ask Kathy Soul to come up, please. This is, why don't you start by telling us if you're still there.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Elizabeth Martin-Mahar, and House, Senate Bill 245 is specifying in the statutes that personal property is exempt from taxation for Indians residing upon federally recognized Indian country. The federal law restricts states from taxing personal property on federally recognized Indian country. This applies to tax years beginning on or after July 1st of 1993. And under current statutes, all Indians residing on reservations, whether it is federally recognized or not, receive the property tax exemption for real and personal property. And this is something that counties are currently doing. They do not tax the personal property of Indians, so this will not have a revenue impact statewide.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Stoll?
Chairman Strobeck and committee, and thank you, Elizabeth, for letting me know that the hearing would be today. Testimony in opposition to Senate Bill 245. Do my civil rights matter to you? You are sworn to protect the rights of all of us equally. Please do so by carefully examining the purpose and wording of Senate Bill 245 and ORS 307180. If you have not gotten a legislative research opinion on this bill in its entirety, please do so before you have a work session. Ask yourselves why the bracketed material is deleted. If the personal property tax is already not charged to the tribes, why is the whole rest of the law changed? Ask legislative counsel what effect that would have. Do you know what, quote, federally recognized Indian country means? Before voting, you need to include the legal definition of federally recognized Indian country in the body of the bill. If it includes non-members in any manner whatsoever, this is an SOS to down this bill. Do not legislate the destruction of my civil rights, nor of other non-member residents that may be included within what will be called federally recognized Indian country. Please keep the bracketed matter in. Please amend this bill to do so and to strike federally recognized Indian country. The next bracketed law that would be deleted by the passage of this bill states in part, quote, shall be exempt from taxation only when so provided by any law of the United States. And case law set by the U.S. Supreme Court, June 8, 1998, decision on Cass County, Minnesota et al. Versus Leaf Lake Band of Chippewa Indians held, quote, state and local governments may impose ad valorem taxes on reservation land that was made alienable by Congress and sold to non-Indians, but was later repurchased by the tribe, end quote. I ask that you either scrap this bill entirely or use it to reverse ORS 307180 to place all lands now exempted from taxation back on the tax rolls for tax years beginning on or after July 1, 1993. And this is under 307-180. I speak to this issue and not other exemptions. This bill is totally vague. I and other non-members hereby assume that, at a minimum, this bill does not give or grant the tribes any taxation or jurisdiction rights upon or over us, even though ourselves and our property may be included under the definition of federally recognized Indian country. We assume that if you pass this bill, as is, your intent is to protect our civil rights. We also assume your intention is simply to exempt from personal property tax the personal property of tribal members residing on trust land, and that this bill does not change the existing status of such real estate under current ORS 307-180. To be perfectly clear, I believe and rely on your intent that this bill affects personal property only and not real property, that you intend to protect the tax support for our school districts by not allowing exemptions to Indian-owned businesses, that your intention is to protect our civil rights by making sure this bill does not grant tribes jurisdiction nor taxation on non-members. The monies we paid, that this bill does not grant tribes or Indians the right to extract any portion of the monies we paid or pay to federal, state, counties, cities, etc. The 14th Amendment to our U.S. Constitution, states' rights, does not give the state legislature the right to violate our civil rights by giving super rights to tribes. Section 20 of the Oregon Constitution insists, quote, no law shall be passed granting any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which, upon the same terms, shall not equally belong to all citizens. We bind you down on Senate Bill 245. And then my husband wrote, I agree Alice Flory from Grand Ronde wrote, I may be affected adversely by this bill. Daryl Mayhern wrote, it seems like this bill's main purpose is to put federally recognized Indian country into the law. What does that mean? Please vote no. And then if you pass Senate Bill 245, please also refer it to the people for a vote. And then on the green, you can see a quote by young Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, treat all men alike, give them all the same law, give them all an even chance to live and grow. All men were made by the same great spirit chief. They are all brothers. The earth is the mother of all people, and all people should have equal rights upon it. And then on the back, another a letter, or it's a letter to the editor out of the Perm newsletter by Bill Lawrence. He's publisher of the Ojibwe News, Native American Press, and member of the Red Light Band of Ojibwe. And he insists a court ruling that allows for separate laws for separate races hasn't worked anywhere, and I hope you'll read that. I brought around other information on this same color, too. I'm not sure. I tried to get every member of the committee. It's kind of hard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope you will consider my concerns. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Merkley.
Will we be hearing from the proponents of this bill about this bill?
We'll be hearing from the Department of Revenue that about some of the definitions and questions raised and the reason for the bill.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, Rosenbaum?
Ms. Toll, did you provide the same testimony on the Senate side when this bill was considered?
Well, no, I didn't. I brought, let's see, there was an article in the paper by, it was about Mike Crowe's Polk County Commissioner. When it came out that it is legal to charge taxes on reservation land, et cetera, and that Mike Crowe said, oh, we don't want to do that because, you know, they're supporting the community and they're this and that and the other. But apparently, I don't know, are there 30 members of the Senate?
Yes.
Okay. 29 voted for it, and one was absent. And I provided that to Jerry George, our own senator, and Marilyn Shannon, I believe, and other information. I was absolutely shocked to find that that passed 29-0. But I know that they're working so hard on the transportation and natural resources that I don't know. As a matter of fact, I went to pick up that information to provide to the House, and Marilyn's office didn't even have what I had provided. So, and Gary George's office had, I think, two pieces of paper, that's all. So I don't think they spent any time on it, and I apologize, Marilyn and Gary, for saying that. That one of the things
they have,
that I...
A lot of their work over here.
One of the things I don't know if you folks are aware of, when the tribe, the Grand Ronde tribe, was given recognition again, our federal Congress mandated they have their own constitution. And in that constitution, they say that they shall take jurisdiction over literally everything, existing laws and rights and everything notwithstanding. And that concerns the rest of us out there because we bought our lands out there. We didn't know anything about. Well, there wasn't such a thing as Indian Reservation in 1983. We didn't know that we would be within the boundaries of the former executive order or whatever you call it, Indian Reservation. And we just got the Celeste newsletter, and in that newsletter, I don't know if it's a chairman's report or what, I can't recall, but they said that all of the tribes in Western Oregon were to situate in the Coast Reservation a little over 1 million acres. Well, you know, I don't want to, I think I'll stop right there. But the Celeste and the Grand Ronde requested termination. It wasn't forced on them. They requested it, and the Celeste said, we want to remove the last vestiges of discrimination against us by paying taxes like everybody else. So, you know, they recognized that that was a kind of a bone of contention. I sure thank you.
Well, please thank you for your coming over and for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Kim?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Maneri with the Department of Revenue. We had this bill drafted because actually some of the county assessors were unclear as to the current status of federal law. The language in it, such as taken lands and severalty, is a little legal. It's a lot of legalese for the assessors to understand. So what we did is we went to the Attorney General's office and said, could you look at the language in the statute? And if it could be clear in terms of reflecting federal law, which overrides any state policy, could we restate the statute in those terms? The language that you find here is what the Attorney General's office drafted in light of the U.S. Supreme Court decisions. The federally recognized Indian country is what did come out of an Oklahoma decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. And fundamentally what it did is extend an exemption beyond simply tribal boundaries. It used to be when it was only the federal reservation boundaries, it was a lot clearer for an assessor to know whether something was exempt or not. But the U.S. Supreme Court has declared that it also includes land that is held in federal trust for Indians if tribal members live on that land outside the reservation. So it includes federal trust, and you must reside on the land. So what this bill is trying to do is simply reflect what the current status of federal law is governing this. And I'd be pleased, if you'd like in another hearing, I'd be pleased to bring the Attorney General's office, the person over that drafted this, to discuss it with you.
That might be helpful to just make sure we get those definitions correct and answer some of these other questions about what. I think we've had bills in the past that talked about federally recognized Indian country. Is there a definition in our statutes of that?
Mr. Chair, no. It's under a U.S. Supreme Court definition.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 245. We'll go into work session on this on another day and get some answers to any questions. We're now going to go to transportation for a while and open a public hearing on House Bill 3344.
Okay.
So get out your big, thick folders. And county folks, Bill Penhollow and guests.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Bill Penhollow, representing the Association of Oregon Counties. With me today on my right are Oliver Snowden, who is the county engineer for Lane County, and Randall Pozdena, Dr. Randall Pozdena, who is an economist with Eco Northwest. Give you a little bit of background on their credentials and why we have asked them to appear before you today. I'd like to note that in 1967, Mr. Snowden was a member of the Cost Responsibility Blue Ribbon Committee that... oh, okay. 96, and submitted a report to the 1997 legislative body on Oregon's cost responsibility system. This was a Blue Ribbon Committee that was chaired by Henry Hewitt, had private sector representatives from the Oregon trucking industry and other private sector people, including representatives from the
University of Oregon, Oregon State University and Portland State University. This committee analyzed Oregon's system and submitted a report to the 97 legislature indicating that basically Oregon's cost responsibilities process was one that should be retained as and was recognized as one of the best approaches in the United States. So Mr. Snowden comes to you today with that background as well as interest in the whole issue of highway financing as a county engineer and a background in analyzing costs on county road systems. Dr. Pozdena is a managing director with ACO Northwest and is the head of its Portland office. He has extensive experience in economics and transportation policy, cost responsibility, and cost allocation analysis and study. So we've asked these two individuals to take a look at the bill before you and analyze it from the standpoint of the Association of Oregon Counties policy, which appears on the second page of the material that we've handed out to you. Before we move on, we had a fourth person that was going to join us this morning, Mr. John O'Shell from Tillamook County, and Mr. O'Shell was unable to attend due to illness in his family. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Association of Oregon Counties has had a policy on Oregon's highway user taxes and cost responsibility for many years. We feel that it is the underpinning of Oregon's highway user system and essential for allocating the appropriate costs to the highway users, be they the automobile owner and user or light trucks or heavy trucks. We feel that before any change in this system that the legislature should consider several principles that we have set out as key in analyzing a comparative system. And you'll be hearing more from Dr. Pozdena and Mr. Snowden on these policy issues, but just let me describe those for you briefly. First is we feel Oregon must retain cost responsibility as a method of identifying the user's appropriate cost. Secondly, any new proposal must be revenue neutral, raising the same amount of revenue that the existing system does, as well as sustainable into the future, that it not only meets that test today, but can meet that test into the future. And it should not shift additional burden to Oregon firms based on a higher cost, unit cost to those firms. This policy was reaffirmed in March by our legislative committee and is the policy that we would recommend that the legislative body consider as they analyze and compare the current weight mile system with the registration diesel tax proposal before. With those comments, let me turn to Dr. Pozdena and ask him to share with you his thoughts about the proposal and its ability to meet the tests that we have set out.
Thank you, Bill. Good morning. As Bill indicated, my name is Randall Pozdena, Managing Director of ECHO Northwest Portland Office. I just want to make three basic points this morning concerning the proposed replacement of Oregon's current weight mile tax system with a combination of weight differentiated registration fees and diesel taxes. Those three points relate first to certain risks to revenue neutrality that I think are inherent in the analysis of the proposal to date. Secondly, certain aspects of the behavioral impact of the change that I think will be potentially adverse not only to revenue neutrality going forward, but also to the rate at which Oregon roads are used and damaged by particularly heavy vehicle activity. To economists, taxes and prices, revenue generating capability is only one dimension of interest. We're also interested in how it affects behavior. And thirdly, whether the very legitimate concern of the industry concerning the administrative costs of the current system can't be resolved in a different way, in a way that preserves the opportunities going forward to keep the user charge system matched to the costs imposed by users. I'll be very brief since I know you've heard a lot of previous testimony on this matter. First, for the revenue neutrality risks, the analysis that was done, I participated with AOC, with the Transportation Coalition, the analysis of revenue neutrality of the proposal. And there are certain risks that I think remain. The analysis assumes that the fleet composition, patterns of registration, and DMT will be unaffected by the proposal. And in my opinion, the industry necessarily will react to minimize their obligations under this program. So there will be changes. They aren't modeled because we didn't know how to do them, but there will be changes. In addition, proposal institutionalizes stickiness in the sources of revenue over time. It's going to be very difficult politically to increase diesel fuel taxes in Oregon above those charged in the surrounding states. So as time passes and our idiosyncratic costs change over time, it's going to be hard to use this mechanism, the diesel fuel tax, to accommodate those changes in costs. The stickiness will cause future revenue problems, further revenue problems in the future. There are compliance problems with registration fees and diesel taxes of this type, weight-differentiated diesel taxes, registration fees, and so forth, that we didn't analyze in detail, even though we know such problems exist today. It was easy to analyze the problems of the weight mile tax because that's what we have today, so we have lots of data on that. Finally, there's no mechanism to automatically adjust the registration fee or diesel tax to make sure that revenue neutrality is maintained should it drift out of balance in the early years of this proposal. And looking forward, because the weight mile tax system itself generates so much data of interest for the cost responsibility process, looking forward, I think that process will be handicapped by the lack of necessary to appropriately allocate cost responsibility. So in summary, all of the risks that are out there appear to be on the side of it being less revenue than anticipated rather than more. My second point concerns the behavior of trucking firms if this bill is approved and what the implications are for Oregon roads. Under the weight mile tax, a typical heavy truck paid about 15 cents per each additional mile that it drove. Under the proposal, because of the reliance on the diesel fuel tax on the margin, it will only pay about 4 cents for each additional mile, somewhere around a factor of 4 reduction in the marginal cost of operating a heavy vehicle an additional mile. As an economist, I have to believe that this will influence behavior in the direction of increasing miles traveled by a truck of a given weight. That 4 cents per additional mile does not cover the cost burden that such trucks impose on Oregon highways, particularly on the vulnerable county and local street systems, which are not built to accommodate heavy vehicles in a cost-effective way. In addition, the registration fee approach, although it is differentiated by weight and by axle configuration, penalizes poorly configured trucks, i.e. trucks with too few axles, less than did the weight mile tax. And you've already heard testimony to this effect by the Willamette University people. This, too, will increase wear and tear on Oregon roads. In summary, the cost of operating and maintaining Oregon roads likely will increase, and this will further exaggerate any revenue neutrality problems that are present when the tax reform itself occurs. My final point concerns the issue of the industry administrative costs, which really are the heart of this, of the logic of this proposed legislation. I believe it's an important issue and deserves to be addressed. My concern is, however, that in the name of seeking simple conformity with states around us, we're chasing, in some sense, a false idol. The goal should be improving the relationship between costs and fees rather than degrading it in the name of uniformity. I want to point out that Europe the economic union is, in contrast, moving away from registration fee and fuel tax mechanisms toward weight mile approaches, just as we're reversing gears. Secondly, there are better ways of addressing the administrative cost issue than disabling the current weight mile tax system. Technology is making electronic tracking of truck location, miles, and even onboard weighing, that is weighing as the truck rolls down the road, more and more economical. The same equipment provides management information to truck operators and perhaps provides ancillary benefits that more than offset their costs. I draw your attention to a study, the Automated Mileage and State Line Crossing Operational Test, AMISCOT, that was conducted by U.S. DOT, Iowa State, and some state DOTs to demonstrate the feasibility of automated mileage tracking. It did so, and it demonstrated the feasibility and economy of these approaches, even under current technology conditions. Technology will never be more expensive than it is today, and at that, the 10-year amortized cost of the necessary onboard equipment was $150 per truck per year for a small carrier, $40 to $50 per year for a large carrier. I listened to a presentation at Portland State University just last week where other technology vendors provided even more interesting and cost-effective alternatives to this problem. The registration fuel tax approach to road taxation is very old-fashioned. We sort of defaulted to it because we didn't have the technology to do a better job. Oregon has a strong reputation in refining its roadway tax devices so as to better match user costs with what the user pays. It is difficult to see why Oregon would want to regress to a method that degrades that relationship, just as we're on the cusp of significant technological opportunities to improve cost responsibility. Just making a private statement here, as a taxpayer, I would gladly bear the additional costs of developing the automated weight mile billing systems and have them provided free to trucking systems and have Oregon roads, particularly the county roads, damaged further by heavy vehicle traffic without compensation. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Oliver Snowden. I'm county engineer with Lane County. I'd like to talk this morning on three points, the implications for county roads if this bill passes, the perception that Oregon's out of step with its weight mile tax, and, again, the administrative burden placed on truckers in reporting on the weight mile tax. Because counties, county engineers and surveyors were concerned about the way our ability to finance county roads, last year we contracted with Dr. Pastina and Echo Northwest to look at suggestions for reforming our method of financing county roads. And there was one notable, conclusion or observation that report made, and that was that county roads are particularly vulnerable to damage inflicted by heavy trucks. So, to account for this, the report recommended a number of alternative ways or potential ways that we could change the way we finance county roads, but all those were founded in the principle of cost responsibility, and that's the theme you'll hear through the rest of my comments this morning. But there were two findings from that report that we think are relevant to the proposal before you in House Bill 3344. First of all, county roads are rarely designed to support axle loadings imposed by heavy trucks. Majority of county roads have low durability construction, and only one-third of county roads have a concrete or asphalt concrete surface. The extent that vehicle miles traveled would increase as a result of the OTA proposal to move away from weight mile taxation, county roads will suffer even more. Secondly, even though the current weight mile taxation system on average achieves cost responsibility, it doesn't accurately reflect the costs imposed on low durability roads. The current taxing system doesn't differentiate between roadway type, locale, or season of the year. So consequently, counties with light durability roads experience excessive wear and tear on their facilities while collecting insufficient revenues to maintain them. And we feel the OTA proposal will make this imbalance even worse. So we're concerned that the bill will foster increased damage to county roads. The question we ask is, where will the funds come to assure long-term revenue neutrality? As Dr. Prasdina mentioned, the ability to raise diesel tax is going to be limited by the diesel tax in adjacent states. and additional increases in fixed fees are likely to move further away from the principle of cost responsibility. Second point I'd like to discuss is the weight mile trends. And one argument that we hear frequently is that Oregon's out of step because we're only one of five states that has a weight mile tax. And we feel that this fact doesn't mean that Oregon's wrong or that we're out of step. It means that we're coming closer to achieving cost responsibility than most states. And again, as Dr. Pazdina mentioned, Europe is moving in that direction and toward a weight mile tax and away from a registration fee diesel tax approach as a way to achieve cost responsibility. And in addition, the Federal Highway Administration has also concluded that a weight distance tax is more equitable than their current system of highway user fees. And again, this is founded in the principle of cost responsibility. The federal tax structure has some similarities to what the OTA proposal is. It includes a vehicle or a fuel tax that varies with mileage traveled, and it includes three fixed fees that are independent of distance traveled. So in 1997, the Federal Highway Administration concluded that the diesel tax is very good at reflecting differences in the amount of travel by various vehicles, but it does a poor job in reflecting differences in cost responsibility related to vehicle weight. And I think that's consistent with some of the comments you heard from the Willamette University study, I believe, yesterday. The incidence of a flat tax, like a registration fee, on a per-mile basis can vary among vehicles with different annual VMT, while their cost responsibilities per mile may be very similar. In all truck classes, the lightest vehicles pay more than their share of highway costs, and the heaviest vehicles pay considerably less than their share of the cost. And finally, much of the inequity in the existing federal highway user fee structure could be reduced with a weight distance tax because it can be calibrated to match the cost responsibility of different vehicle classes at different weights and operational characteristics. And in addition, about 10 years ago, there was a report by the USDOT that concluded that acceptable levels of compliance could be achieved with a national weight distance tax and noted that mileage records that most carriers already maintain should be adequate to comply with a weight distance tax. The last point I'd like to make is that dealing with reporting requirements. And I know that some people characterize the reporting requirements of weight mile as onerous and inherently unfair to truckers, and they contend that if this proposal is in fact revenue neutral, then it's only reasonable that we should move to a fuel tax registration fee and abandon weight mile. And I would suggest that this logic, and this is the point, again, of cost responsibility. While we disagree that the proposal is revenue neutral, especially in the long run, we do agree that we should be exploring ways to reduce the weight mile administrative costs that are placed on truckers. The technology already exists to automate most of the data collection necessary to comply with weight mile reporting, and the costs of this technology are surely to be driven down in the next few years, just as the cost of personal computers have been driven down in the last several years. So rather than eliminate the weight mile tax now, just at the point where technology is going to greatly reduce the ability or reduce the paperwork associated with weight mile reporting, we suggest that tax reduction incentives, like those listed in House Bill 2082, be implemented to ease the expense and burden on truckers on an interim basis while we move to a fully electronic data collection system. I won't repeat the incentives that are in House Bill 2082. I'm sure you're aware of those, but generally they would give reductions to truckers who would file electronically or use transponders in data collection. So in conclusion, I'd like to suggest that House Bill 3344 represents a major shift in Oregon's highway user fee structure. It provides an advantage to heavy high-mileage trucks at the expense of lighter, lower-mileage trucks, and its passage would end 50 years of fair, cost-responsible truck taxation. So I urge you to do three things. Number one, retain the weight mile system. It's the only available system we have right now that comes close to cost responsibility. As Dr. Pazdina mentioned, Europe's moving in that direction, and the Federal Highway Administration has concluded that it's more equitable than the current fuel tax flat fee system that the federal government has. Secondly, I'd urge you to support the reporting efficiency measures included in House Bill 2082. And finally, I would urge you to authorize an interim study that would detail the institutional changes and the costs necessary to implement a voluntary automated data collection and reporting system for trucks. Technology exists today to do this. Institutional barriers stand in the way. And we believe that a system that would be based on private, third-party data collection management concessionaires could overcome some of those barriers. So the study and an implementation schedule could be presented to the 2001 legislature. Actually, there'd be two ways to do this because the Angers version of House Bill 2082 does include some provision that would direct ODOT to perform this study. So you could do it that way, or you could do it through a legislative interim committee. And I'll close by mentioning that our Board of Commissioners, about a month ago, on a majority vote, went on record in supporting the principle of cost responsibility and opposing legislation that would move Oregon away from cost responsibility taxation for trucks. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to answer any questions if the committee has questions, and I believe we have copies of the Lane County letter, which we will get to the committee.
Okay. Thank you all. Are there any questions? Mr. St. Ross?
And I have sounded them on other issues before, so I'm not worried about whether or not they have proved this or not, but it seems kind of funny to me. And the question to you is, you know, why would AOC really be concerned about the mechanism for taxation and for the dollars into the highway fund here? Why would they really care if we have enough money there to support our counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Welch, I think it's for the principles that we've set out in our policy statement. We're concerned that the proposal before us will be able to meet revenue neutrality, as Dr. Pozdena indicated. We feel that it's all of the considerations are in favor of the trucking industry, and really questions about whether initially and certainly into the future it's going to be able to maintain the revenue source that the current system has. Particularly as we move into the future and adjustments are necessary to maintain the revenue flow that we've would anticipate from the weight mile tax would require more than likely some significant increases in registration fees and or diesel tax or a combination of those, as testified to you yesterday by AAA of Oregon, Idaho. We also are concerned about drifting away from the whole concept of cost responsibility. We feel that that kind of analysis needs to be maintained so that as bodies like yourself in the future look at allocating costs to the users for financing improvements and maintenance of the road system, that there would not be a shift of the burden away from the user that is causing the cost to other users. So I think our association has concern from that standpoint, and being elected officials in their communities, I think they likewise have concern, Representative Welch, about the equity of any taxing system on Oregon-based companies. And so we have put together, with the involvement of the counties, this policy statement, and that's what we are applying and what guides us in making our assessment on any changes in this tax structure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welch, another concern that the counties would have would be the potential that the new system would encourage, as Dr. Pacinas mentioned, poorly configured trucks. In other words, the current system penalizes poorly configured trucks, those with too few axles. The fewer axles, the heavier the load, the more the damage to the road. So that's a side effect that we're concerned about.
I think we all are, and I think we all are here very concerned about making sure we have the right amount of revenue coming in, user fees for our highway. But why would you want to support a cost responsibility effort here in this state that would possibly start, as you can see, it's quite a self-evident, it's very difficult right now to make sure that we have those dollars. We could transfer that from late mile over to registration. You see the increases on registration and then on a fuel tax. You see really now how much they are paying. And we support cost responsibility that could run industry out of this state into other states. It's quite evident. But we have a problem here, and the industry is asking for some help. So that's what concerns me. I think it's quite evident if we get more and more information from both sides of this. But we've got a problem here. And I think it's up to us as a legislature. We recognize our responsibility here. That we want to maintain that revenue and our opportunity for the state. And I guess some of those fears and everything are what come out of this effort. But I just don't see where the county plays into this overall.
Chair Skolbeck, Representative Welsh, I don't envy your position because you do have a very complex issue before you and there are no simple issues. And I recognize that each one of you are struggling with this. And that's the purpose of our presentation, to try to provide you with additional information from our perspective so that you can consider that as you arrive at your own personal conclusions on this legislation. Thank you.
Well, I guess just to follow up, though, I came through the county's concern, especially you mentioned the axle load issue and encouraging maintaining a system that that provides incentive for the proper axle for loads. Again, knowing that some experience in county roads, but county roads typically are not constructed to the same standards that state highways and freeways are constructed, and they are then more susceptible to the kind of damage that I think that you would see from vehicle loads that aren't supported by the proper number of axles. So I can see where counties would have a big stake in that. And I guess, too, commenting on Representative Welsh's concerns or comments about the industry asking for this, my sense is that a segment of the industry is asking for it, and a segment of the industry, as we heard yesterday, is asking not. So I think that's a mixed question. And we will, I think, clearly see some loss of small businesses based on the increase in the registration fees, as much as we will see savings in other areas.
I wonder if I might, Representative Shirley and Representative Welsh, respond to the issue of, that I think is very important, whether the costs to truckers already in the state of Oregon are so high that we risk running these businesses out of our state. And I would argue that proposal is a prescription for increasing those costs, because if you don't give operators of trucks a cost-based price incentive as they use a facility, whether it's a county road, freeway, or whatever, their overuse will occur if that use of that facility is underpriced. That overuse increases wear and tear, increases costs. So the next legislative cycle, the bill is higher. That is, the bill that needs to be paid is higher. Cost responsibility allocates costs fairly in the aggregate, but it doesn't really deal with this sort of death spiral finance problem. It really is the fundamental problem that most state DOTs face today, where there's overuse on the margin, generating costs that are uncompensated, and then when the bill is delivered, everyone's surprised.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the last page of your testimony, Mr. Snowden, you note that there are institutional barriers that stand in the way automated data collection. Could you expand on that?
Well, my understanding is that the trucking industry is not very enthused about having government have access to every movement of every truck on every highway. And what we're suggesting is to move to an automated data collection reporting system. Government doesn't have to be the vehicle that operates that. It can be a system operated by private the session airs. Government's only role would be to provide oversight to certify that these concessionaires, in fact, have the accurate technology and are honest about doing business. And then all government sees is aggregated data, only aggregated data that's necessary for the weight mile reporting. So that gets government out of the detailed oversight of, like I say, every truck on every road at every time of day. So that's certainly one institutional barrier.
One more question here. Related to the reporting requirements, we had testimony that showed a large stack of documents that's necessary to file in the current system and a small stack that's necessary under the proposed system. And we had subsequent testimony saying that in terms of the information that's tracked, it's virtually identical under the two systems. But the difference is between reporting on a fleet with one paper, with a whole bunch of paper that backs it up, or sending all that paper forward, is there in fact, so is the apparent savings when you look at the different stacks of paper a real savings?
I think the apparent savings isn't a real savings. Mostly information that's collected by trucking firms is needed for their internal management and optimization of their own services. I think there are, though, a lot of things that could be done to streamline and improve that process for the truckers' benefit. And I do think they have a legitimate concern about administrative costs. But this isn't a bill about how to solve administrative costs. It's a bill about changing the entire way that the highway system is paid for. And I think that's a long way around the barn to achieve that. And a direct approach would be, I understand that there is some legislation elsewhere to try to address this with new procedures, both auditing and electronic type procedures.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. More question. Under our current system, we allocate all of the administrative costs of the weight mile system to the trucking industry, but it's clear from testimony that there's a larger public purpose that has savings to all of us as a result of the weight mile system. Is it really fair to allocate all the administrative costs to the trucking industry?
Well, I think that's a very, very interesting question. I think it's good that it has been allocated to them because now they're able and interested in offering a vigorous response to avoid those costs, and that helps discipline administrative systems and so forth. So in that sense, I think it is important that they understand those and recognize those costs. But I think the cost of transitioning to a new technology, which the trucking industry itself perhaps cannot mount for the research and development effort to support, I think is something that would serve public purposes and might be a realm in which the legislature might want to assist from the side.
Thank you.
Just one other question. I think your point, Mr. Costina, about revenue neutrality, I think everybody wants to maintain revenue neutrality and cost responsibility within the class of trucks. The question I had has to do with your point B about the behavior of trucking firms likely to change because of the reduction in the amount per mile. Is it really fair to just take the tax in isolation and say that will cause additional miles to be traveled, or is there a supply-demand factor involved here, a little free market? You know, trucks aren't going to drive on the road just because it's cheaper to drive if they don't have anything to haul. So can you address that a little bit from an economics point of view?
I think that's a very, very fair comment, Mr. Chairman. It is definitely true that the overall pattern of trucking in the aggregate is driven by supply and demand, where commodities are produced and where they're needed and so forth. But on the margin, we observe trucking firms with different backhaul rates, the amount that the truck is filled on the backhaul. There are different ways to locate and utilize trucks of different weights. So there will be changes operationally, we know, in response to something that offers as big an incentive as this does to minimize the number of trucks that drive them lots and lots of miles. And I don't know what those changes will be for any given operator, but we know that those are the incentives that are out there. And my point is that's a risk to revenue neutrality. Hopefully the legislature can keep up with this risk and any deterioration in revenue neutrality that occurs over time. I'm simply pointing out that that is definitely something that doesn't cut in favor of more revenue than otherwise. It certainly is a risk to revenue neutrality.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can't ask my question. That was essential.
Mr. Ehrenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My testimony will be especially given that we share a position with the counties on this, relatively brief. Thinking about this issue on the way down this morning, I was thinking about how much it's just been a pain in the neck for the last two sessions since I've worked as a lobbyist, and I was going to do an analogy saying it. I look forward to this testifying and working on this issue as much as I do to going to my brother-in-law, the dentist, for a root canal. But the one thing I thought was, at least with the root canal, it ends and gets better. And this just keeps going on.
You get anesthetic.
I'm feeling it.
Our concern from the city perspective on this isn't really regarding what mechanism is used to collect truck taxes. We don't have a dog in the fight of the mechanism. We have a dog in the fight of ensuring that whatever mechanism is utilized ensures a cost responsibility and also provides that we will maintain cost responsibility into the future. And the proposal before you, we credit the trucking industry with a great effort and also with just a real open attitude in its development by coming forward and putting something on the table early for folks to shoot at and raise issues with and to try to improve, and we think they did try to improve it and have worked really diligently and in a manner that's much better than this issue has been approached in the past. So today we still have concerns with the proposal that's before you. Some have been raised, or actually most have been raised, by other speakers. We helped fund the study that was done by the Willamette professors. We participated in the AOI work group and, you know, watched the proceedings there. Some of the issues were go back that are still on the table to the work group that was convened by the Transportation Committee with Representative Lehman and Representative Wells. Those issues that are still remaining from there are that while this proposal makes an attempt to be revenue neutral, there are not mechanisms in it that guarantee revenue neutrality into the future. There is the provision that floats the diesel tax for 18 months to try to raise it up or down to equate with what the share of truckers from that source should be. We applaud that. The trucking industry has been unwilling to extend that into the future or do a similar mechanism for the registration fee so that even absent legislative action, that the proposal could maintain revenue neutrality given the uncertainties with the proposal, uncertainties that you've heard from other speakers, uncertainties as to, gee, we're going to raise registration fees by thousands and thousands of dollars and expect that the truck registration rates will stay the same, and the many others that are included in the proposal. Also, this proposal does not include an increase or to balance off the increase that is also sitting before your committee in 2082. We asked questions of the trucking industry in the fall. If there was a 4-cent increase or a 6-cent increase, how would you balance it off? In the fall, they said that they'd take it mostly on the registration fee. If that's the case, the registration fee with a 4-cent increase would increase an additional approximately $1,000. If it was a 6-cent increase, maybe up to $1,500 more, added to a $3,600 registration fee, put you close to $5,000. And that's the second concern that we have, is that the sustainability of the mechanism that's before you. That taking hearing from mayors and communities when they raise their water bills by $20, $30 a month, they take a lot of heat. Just seeing the constituents will be getting bills that used to be $320, or having bills that used to be $320 bills and potentially getting a $5,000 bill in the mail, I don't think that they're going to call Bob Russell. And that's our concern, is that what that does is creates an awful lot of pressure to decouple in the future cost responsibility from truck taxes and the system that we've had that's worked effectively in Oregon for so many years. I think the what's before the committee today is not really the best solution or how normally Oregon goes in resolving issues. That what's before the committee today is an either or, is either go to away from Waite Mile to the registration diesel system or stay the current course. Just in all the years listening to this issue, it seems to me that there's a third option here, which is to listen to what the concerns raised by the trucking industry have been, which to a large degree have been the administrative cost, the administrative burden, bookkeeping issues with the existing system. And what we haven't done in this process is sat down with the trucking industry, with the Department of Transportation, with whomever, and looked at, are there other ways of trying to fix the problems that people voice about our existing system? There has been an unwillingness on the part of the trucking industry to do that because it's been detraction their efforts to use those excuses to repeal the Waite Mile system. One thing that I think has been a hallmark of public process in Oregon has been to consider what the problem is that we're trying to solve and craft a solution that works for Oregon here. And I think with the legislation that's before you, that that is not the case and not what has happened. There is a solution, and the question is, what's the problem it's trying to address? If the problem is administration, let's address that problem. But I think that the issue is just the desire of an industry to just repeal that system for whatever reasons. My personal feeling was that it's been, you know, fair and equitable in an economic sense, and that works to some of the industry's disadvantage. So we have concerns with this proposal. Earlier on in the fall, I went to our board and said, I think we're making progress, and I'm hopeful that we will be able to support what the industry has brought forward so we can get out of this locking of horns on this issue and move on to the important focus that we need to have on transportation of fixing and maintaining and our system rather than fighting this battle. But unfortunately, I don't think we've reached that point yet. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that, I'm open to any questions.
Thank you, Dan. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Roscoe.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Carl Hostica. I'm a professor at the University of Oregon, although I'm not speaking on behalf of the University of Oregon, and I won't tell you about all my PhDs and everything like that. I was asked by the trucking industry to analyze the economics data and the study that's been put before this committee, and that's why I'm here today. My expertise is in economic policy, tax policy, and primarily on how information is used in the policy-making process. As most of you know, I served in the House of Representatives for 12 years and 10 years on this committee, and I must say it's fun to be back in hearing Room A talking about transportation again. I always say when the dogwood turns pink, it's time to fight. I noticed it was pink on my way in today. My general comments on the report, and I'm talking primarily about the Willamette University report that was presented to you yesterday, is that the report is well written and for the most part is internally consistent. And I think the authors did a good job given the nature of their assignment, the time they had, and the data that was available to them. But I think that the study fails to support its conclusions because it's primarily based on hypothetical reasoning and doesn't take into account the real world. So I'm going to make a few comments on that. The major issues that are dealt with here are revenue neutrality. You've heard a lot of talk about revenue neutrality, and all that talk is based upon assumed behavioral responses to changes in the tax system. And I know this committee hears a lot of testimony about anticipated responses to one proposal after another. However, the evidence in case after case, as the chair pointed out earlier, is that tax policy is a relatively minor component in decisions that people make, whether it be locating a business, driving a truck, or anything else. And I must agree with Dr. Posdina that economists have to assume that taxes make a difference, but the evidence shows that that's not really the case. So that in the trucking business, as been pointed out, the size and weight regulations, customer demand are far more important for decision-making than taxes. But to the extent the tax policy is a factor, most trucking companies have already adjusted to the states around us, which have systems similar to that proposed by the OTA. It's interesting to me to look at the discussion of evasion in this study because I was a little bit confused by it. One part of the report, the authors of the study rely on evasion as a way of saying that the proposal will not be revenue neutral. But in a later part of the report, they say that there would be less revenue lost to evasion under the OTA proposal than under the current system. And they don't talk about how that current evasion affects cost responsibility. I think this whole discussion of cost responsibility, which I'll deal with later, assumes that the system is complete, comprehensive, and completely complied with, and we know there is evasion. We don't know what the effects of that are on cost responsibility. Then there's the discussion of shifts among categories of trucks. Again, this is basically hypothetical. It is not based on actual data. I would say in my experience on this committee that this committee usually favored studies based upon actual data when we were examining tax proposals and looked at the number of people in the various classes that would be affected and how those people would actually be affected. And the studies before you so far haven't dealt with that. And I'd just like to point out a couple things. One is that the cliff effect that is related about 60,000 pounds, 30,000 miles, there is hypothetically a cliff effect. However, that there don't seem to be very many trucks in that category, and I'm sure that if there were, there would be more of them here talking to you about it. The other thing is that the vast majority of trucks are registered in the 80,000 pound class. That category alone is 100 times larger than the next largest category. So that it means that the trucks are unevenly distributed across weight classes, and so any generalization you'd make about shifts are very hazardous. Hypothetically, they may be there, but whether they're actually there is very difficult to tell. And I would also say that on the hypothetical data, when I looked at this, the assertion that out-of-state trucks would pay a lot less than Oregon trucks, in order to make that assertion, you had to assume that the out-of-state state truck would travel twice as far as an Oregon truck, and that it would travel 520 miles a day for every day of the year. And I hope that the trucking industry is that efficient, but I doubt it. On to cost responsibility, part of the claim for cost responsibility is the revenue neutrality. You have to deal with that first before you deal with cost responsibility as far as cars or trucks. I think that's called cost allocation, so we'll use that term. The problem with cost responsibility as it currently exists is that there are numerous exemptions and separate treatments for what I call deserving classes of trucks because I sat on that committee when we voted a lot of them in. And log trucks, dump trucks, agriculture vehicles, others, they all have exemption special fee structures. And that treatment makes it so that the current system is a long way away from cost responsibility already. So I say the heart of my testimony is the next statement, that any assertion that hypothetical shifts in an uneven system will destroy cost responsibility is beyond the capability of even the best trained economists. The people who have testified are well trained, but I think that they're making statements beyond their capabilities. The conclusion that I'd like to leave you with is that making public policy, as you know, involves making judgments about uncertain futures. And all economic studies that attempt to predict the future are based upon simplifying assumptions that ignore the complexity of the real world. They have to be, because you can't model the real world. You have to simplify. And they inevitably create the impression that we know more about the future than we actually do. And I think this is the problem, that our best judgment is based upon knowing what we don't know. And in this case, we really don't know what will happen if we adopt this change in the law or any other proposal. But we get into trouble when we act as if we know, when in fact we really don't know. And so my feeling is making a judgment based upon faulty studies or simplified analysis could easily lead to trouble, and that this committee ought to look at what's before them and then still make the judgments that you have to make, which is, in my judgment, primarily political.
Thank you very much. Good testimony. Representative Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor Hostica, one of the questions I wanted to ask you is a question that I put to and the chairman actually just asked it a while ago. I asked it yesterday. But it relates to this issue that you kind of raised at the end of your testimony where you talk about the inability to predict with any certainty the market effect. For example, an 11-fold increase in the registration fees would have. And you state in your final conclusion, other states have already adopted essential features of the OTA proposal, and since it's worked in those states, we can assume that it would work in Oregon. In your analysis, have you examined any other states where there's been an 11-fold increase?
No, I wasn't. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams. I'm not here to give testimony about the effects of it or analysis of other states. I don't have that analysis. Maybe somebody else does.
I guess I'll be done then, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Okay, well.
Mr. Hostica, in your estimation, looking at this proposal before us, trucking industry proposal before us, how would, in your estimation, would it affect transportation now and in the future?
Well, my primary concern has always been to try to make sure that we had adequate financing for the roads and to make sure that, to the extent possible, that that was fair. And I would say that in all of my efforts, some of which were successful and some of which weren't, to provide adequate funding for the roads, that the only times we were successful is when the trucking industry was part of the coalition that made the effort work. And so that I think that if the concern of this, and I'm speaking here entirely on my own, not on behalf of anybody, but if the concern of this committee is to try to reach some overriding goal of trying to make sure that we have well-financed and good roads, then I think you have to have the trucking industry working with you and not against you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Welcome back. You can dial us on the internet now. You know, you can be a part of the committee every day.
Yeah.
This is going out over the world.
No, but the audio is.
Audio
is. You can click it on. Okay, is there anyone else here today who wants to speak in public testimony on House Bill 3344? Okay. We have our work cut out for us in resolving that. I'll close the public hearing then, House Bill 3344. And we'll go back to the work session on the first two items that were on the agenda. Open a work session on House Bill 2792.
I'm not sure you are.
Okay. Elizabeth, would you tell us about the amendments that we have in mind?
Okay. What you have before you is a -8 amendment, and the -8 is just a modification of the -6 amendment, and it was just trying to correct a couple different areas of the -6 that didn't get quite correct. So to begin with, same as what we talked about, having a 3% rebate for seniors, the income level not to exceed $30,000. It's for property tax years beginning on or after July 1st of 2001. And then in section 5, that's where that stated that was changed from the dash 6 amendment, which is putting 2001 instead of 2002. So this is a claim that will begin in April of 2002, and that is stated at the very end, section 9, where it's saying income tax years beginning on or after January 1st of 2001. These estimates were adjusted slightly, taking out the senior deferral participants. I assume there that since this rebate is pretty small, just about $40 per senior, that it's probably not going to deter participants that are currently in the senior deferral program. They will probably choose to still stay in the program and not file a claim for the senior property tax rebate. So another issue was making sure that it was clear that if the seniors had to decide after year 2001 if they wanted to have that rebate or not, then they were going to have to go off the senior deferral program. So if they stayed on the senior deferral program, they cannot have a rebate. But if they went off after 2001, they could.
Okay. There's numerous public hearings about this, Representative
Corey. I have a question, Mr. Chair. When we were working on Representative Witt's bill about the disabled deferral, we raised the income limit. Did we do that for seniors yet?
Yeah, Representative Corey, that was included in that for seniors. Yeah, and there was a dash 4 that was, you know, incorporated into this bill, but since that time I have gone through and made sure that we have corrected all the statutes in Representative Witt's bill, so we don't need that dash 4 in order to make those changes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I understand that the policy of the bill was to provide assistance to low-income seniors to remain in their homes. Is somebody going to make a straight-faced argument that a $40 a year tax credit is going to encourage somebody to stay in their homes? Is that going to make the difference between staying in home or not in the home? I'm just. It is a rhetorical question, I guess. I'm looking at the revenue impact statement here that we got this morning. And the rebate is estimated a little over $40 per senior, and yet on the flip side of that, we're putting a $9 million per year hole in the general fund. It seems to me kind of the worst of both worlds. We're creating a significant revenue hit to the general fund, but we're not doing it in such a way that materially benefits anybody.
Well, I guess that's because when we had it at the level where it materially benefited somebody.
Couldn't afford that. Yeah, I was going to say it.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I know we've talked about this a lot, but in a follow-up to the point made by Representative Shetterly, would it be worthwhile to adjust that adjusted gross income number from 30,000 down lower, so it would potentially raise the effect. In other words, to reach to the lowest of the low income within the bracket.
Well, I'm not inclined to do that at this point. We need to get House bill out of the House at this point in the session. If the sponsors of the bill want to do that on the Senate side, they could propose that. This is actually a significant reduction from where they wanted to start out anyhow. They wanted it to be broader based and not just low income, but just seniors in general. You know, there are middle income seniors who are also feeling squeezed out of their homes or who have that perception. I think in response to Representative Shetterly's comment, the combination of the 3% cap under Measure 50 along with something like this has a cumulative effect and probably would be of benefit to some seniors that are in a particular income class.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Martin.
It's my impression that a very large percentage of seniors, since by virtue of retirement, have income under $30,000, but may have significant funds put aside in the form of IRAs, or other retirement funds, or may have significant capital built up in their homes. And it appears to me that this, as currently crafted really doesn't target those who are necessarily in need by taking a close look at where one's financial position is. But I'm saying this more as a question to my colleagues because I haven't immersed myself in it as much as I would like to have at this moment.
Mr. Chair, I'm in complete agreement with Representative Merkley on this. And I find that, in fact, there are 70% of seniors in Oregon who would qualify for this whose adjusted gross income per year does not exceed $30,000. And I really find it hard to believe that we can classify all 70,000 of those as low-income seniors, as the staff summary statement says. And whenever when this bill comes to us, I immediately think of my 90-year-old grandmother who is living in her home, and while she is by no means well off, she would be angry to receive a check for $4 in the mail, knowing the problems that we have in the state of Oregon, when she does not need that $40. And I know that what she's going to say to me when she gets this $40 in the mail, she's going to start getting mad.
There's no requirement, I don't think, that people apply for this. If you didn't want to get the rebate, you wouldn't have to apply for it. Okay.
Yeah. I remain very concerned. I've seen a couple of different runs on tax credits that have already passed and tax credits that are yet ahead of us, and having yet figured out how we're balancing the budget at the end of the day. And I think that senior deferral program seems to be solving the fundamental issue in a reasonable win-win solution all the way around the block. And I don't think I will be supporting this particular bill at this particular time.
That's okay. Mr. Chair, still kind of processing this, but certainly the $40 isn't going to, the goal originally was that we assist people in staying in their homes, and $40 isn't going to do that. Just the process of the administrative overhead for processing such a small rebate makes us fairly inefficient. We've looked at other possibilities in this committee, but we don't have them before us on the table, that have similar price tags. I'm just not sure this is the carefully crafted, and it's easy for us, it's always easy to spend money, but is this money proportional to the public policy purpose? And I'm not sure that we've achieved that. I think we need to be very, as our society goes into a period when demographically a larger and larger percentage of us are retired, we need to be extremely careful in how we target our policies so that we're really affecting the need. Otherwise, we'll be putting ourselves in just a difficult financial situation without having really provided a public policy purpose.
Other comments?
Mr. Chair, I would just also like to add that we are leaving out an entire group of seniors with this measure, seniors that are living in nursing homes or assisted living homes, who those folks could probably use this $40 rebate a lot more than those who are living in homes of an unspecified amount. Somebody could be living in a home that's worth $350,000 and they will be getting this $40 rebate. So I think if we're trying to look at honoring our seniors, which I think is a very admirable goal, then maybe we should take a look at all seniors and not just those who are fortunate enough to own their own homes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the motivation of those who brought this bill because it's I think it addresses an area where there is need, and I think to respond to Representative Kefouri's remarks, I think what this bill is designed to do is two things. Number one is to alleviate some of the financial burden on seniors, but also to make it more possible for them to stay in their home, those who live in a home and who are paying property taxes. I am troubled by the fact that this rebate or credit, that tax rebate now is down to as low as $41 or $42 per person. And you have to, at that point, begin to question, does this really accomplish those objectives, particularly looking at the administrative costs, as Representative Murphy has pointed out, in terms of processing that. And I think those who brought this legislation have been caught in that whipsaw between trying to minimize the fiscal impact and at the same time trying to bring about substantive relief. And I think maybe they've lost the substantive relief because of the concern over the fiscal impact. I don't blame them for that. I think we ought to be sensitive to the fiscal impact. I'm not troubled that this does not look at assets that a senior might own, however, because the deferral program doesn't do that either. It simply looks at income. But I think that the deferral program actually accomplishes whatever this bill would accomplish, namely that those who can't afford all of their property taxes, to whatever extent they can't afford it, can defer them, and with a minimal interest charge, and it protects the interest of the state because of the lien on the property. And consequently, as this bill has evolved and where it is today, I don't see it really adding anything over and beyond what the deferral program does. So reluctantly, I'm in a position looking at the fiscal impact and looking at how we might use those dollars in other places, particularly for low-income families with children. I don't think that this bill is adding significantly to what's available under the deferral program already. And thus, I would reluctantly cannot in good judgment support it in its current form.
Well, you want to give any comments on this? If you're primary sponsor, I hate to put you on the spot. You don't have to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The intent of this bill was not just to help low-income, it was to honor seniors. Because it's been changed so much, as Representative Wood has said, the impact has been decreasing. I had hoped, you know, we could be at 5%, 36,000. But I can see that there's some concerns with the committee. And I also do want to help families with children. So I respect your judgment on this. I would still like to see us honor seniors. But I respect your judgment on what you want to do with this bill.
Well, okay. Comments, Representative Glenn?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Close, I do appreciate your efforts on this bill, and I don't mean to give a sense that, you know, at the last minute I'm opposing it. I think simply when we look at what it now substantively accomplishes, it's not very much for the price that's being paid. And we do have the deferral program in place, which is brings meaningful help in a much higher dollar number to seniors. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm concerned as we start passing these tax changes that will cause revenue that we're going to, I think we need to be very judicious how we do it. And as you made the comment, which I think was repeating what I said, which I appreciate, is that at this point, I think we need to look at low-income families with children in terms of about bringing some relief, because they don't have something like the senior deferral on the books today. But I do appreciate your efforts to help seniors with this bill.
I think this is very different from the deferral program, and I don't think this is something that, there's a big difference, I think, between the deferral program, which totally eliminates taxes, and this, which I think was designed as a way to encourage people to consider remaining in their homes. And as I said, with the Measure 50 cap, 3%, there still might be levies that go outside that, but for the most part, the property taxes are not going up dramatically every year. But what this does is just on a rather token basis, but it still is a real dollar amount, helps people to be able to make that decision when they're looking at their, you know, discretionary spending on a month-to-month basis, and it's pretty, pretty small. Granted, $40 is not very much, but it's something. So I don't know. I think there's a statement that's being made there, as well as something that can be certainly expanded. I think we ought to give it a chance to let people see, and maybe they'll embrace this and say, great, this is how we want to see tax relief. You know, a lot of folks are elected on the principle of providing some sort of tax relief this session. And while this is a small step, I think it's one that that certainly bears at least taking a first step. And, if people are concerned about the $40 at 3%, I would suggest conceptually amending it up to 5%. We could assume that that would be another, $3 or $4 million on top of that. Great. Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Well, Mr. Chair, what does that raise in terms of dollars then? Where are we up to $50?
If 3% is $40,
65.
Okay, let's double it. Let's say 6%. Let's make it $80. It's ironic that we had the last couple of times this bill was up here, people were very stressed out about the revenue impact. So it's been reduced so much in order to accomplish the goal of minimizing the revenue impact, and now people are saying, I don't want to pass the bill because it's too little. I'm a little concerned about this. I think we ought to be voting on this on policy direction. You either like it or you don't like it.
Mr. Chairman, in your opinion, does passing this out, and let's say doubling it to an average of $80 per senior and then having a revenue impact of about $36 million in the next biennium, does that undermine the opportunity of this committee to provide some substantive tax relief for low-income families with children, for example? I want to be helpful to seniors. At the same time, a lot of studies have shown that it's low-income families with children that are the most stressed financially today, not seniors. And we do have the deferral, property tax deferral program for low-income seniors that does provide meaningful relief. So I don't want to pass this out and then crowd out that opportunity for low-income families with children. Frankly, I think have a real compelling case to make in terms of property tax relief, or for example, the relief for those who are caring for disabled members of their family. I mean, I'm concerned about the cumulative impact from crowding out other opportunities.
Well, I share that concern, and that's why there's some other policy decisions that are coming over from the Senate. For example, the pension bills that I think are totally off the mark. Just say forgive all taxes on all pensions. I think the needs of families, especially families with lost kids, are certainly greater than that. This is a different style of a bill, though. This is talking about people who have purchased their homes, and I'm sure when you go door to door, I certainly had this in my district. Some people come to the door and they say, "I'm having to sell this house because I can't pay the taxes anymore." I mean, I think that's why we've had the two big tax limitation measures already this decade. And
Mr. Chair, one correction. I don't have my fiscal numbers, but I believe the 5% at $30,000 was not $36 million. I believe it was 15. But you have those sheets, but I don't have them with me.
Yeah, that's
Mr. Chairman.
Representative what?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, based on the discussion we've had here today, if you, Mr. Chairman, want to increase it to 5 or 6% and want to conceptually offer that amendment, I'll support it and support moving the bill. I mean, ultimately, the Senate has to approve it, and these things are going to have to be worked out in terms of what we can afford. I don't mind this being in the mix, Mr. Chairman. I just would make the point that I don't want the committee to see this as crowding out other opportunities, particularly opportunities for low-income families with children.
I appreciate this thing. I appreciate that, Representative. And, ultimately, all these things are going to have to be put on the table. We'll see how much there is going out the door and how much we've committed to spending and figure out where we are.
I'm sorry. I'm just real confused about this. What I mean by ultimately we have to put all of this on the table, and yet at the same time you're wanting to move this today. When is that table going to be constructed?
There's got to be a process toward the end of the session where we see all the bills that have come from both chambers, and then start adding up the impact. Conference committee, things like that.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
okay, well,
I would offer the conceptual amendment that we move from 3% to 5%.
In the -8 amendment?
Yeah, in the -8 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'm just finding it really difficult that we haven't been able to come up with any substantial money for affordable housing this session. I would sure love to have the $10 million or $15 million that we're going to spend on this program for people that are already living in homes to help those who don't have any place at all to live. And I'd like for us to take that into consideration, but I know it's you don't want to be put pitting people of different classes or different generations against each other, which unfortunately we seem to be doing this session. But I think in terms of prioritizing on a scale, who do we want to help? I'd like to look at those seniors who don't have any place to live, who are being forced out of their homes because their rent is going out of control.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Who is that?
That's me.
Okay.
Let's bring back in the Trucking Association.
The roofing.
Another unanswerable.
Yeah, unponderable. I had committed to support the Dash 8, and I'm prepared to do that through gritted teeth today in spite of my comments for the purpose of the courtesy to get it out. I couldn't support increasing it to 5% and the revenue impact that would have on the general fund, again, looking at targeting where those dollars could better be used. I think it's just put this farther out of balance.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
For comparison, I believe, and perhaps someone has a better number, but I believe that the general fund budgeted allocation under the governor's budget for all of our affordable housing programs is $20 million for the biennium, which is equivalent to what we're doing in this single bill. At this point, it's not been at all clear that the governor's $20 million would be found. It wouldn't be found in our existing budget. And if we take an additional $20 million off the table, that certainly will make it much harder to do so.
Okay, let's take a little vote count here on Dash 8. As currently constructed, with a 3%, anticipating that this would then at least move forward to further discussion on the Senate side, since we do need to get House bills out of this chamber. How many votes are there to move the Dash 8? We have them currently. Any votes down here? Okay. The chair moves adoption of the Dash 8 amendments as written into House Bill 2792. Any more discussion? Any objection?
I object.
Senator Rasmussen objects. The Dash 8 is adopted. The chair moves House Bill 2792 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any more discussion?
Chair. I have a little different take on this than others that have spoken, and I oppose it too, but I think for me, we really are not in a climate this session to be talking about new tax exemptions and tax breaks, and I think that's unfortunate because I think we really did have the opportunity to take a look at the existing ones, but and how difficult it is to do away with those. And you know, in light of testimony we had just the other day about some others that we didn't even look at, like linking to the federal tax code and exempting second home mortgages, I mean, that to me has far less public policy behind it than what's presented to us in this bill. And that's what I'd like to see us do is trade off some of those that maybe don't represent such good policy. But because that's not what's before us, I have trouble, given our funding difficulties, in supporting new ones, and that's why I will be voting no on this.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rasmussen.
$9 million can do a lot to honor our citizens. I've sat on Human Resources, Ways and Means, and generally speaking, that's a process where we bring forward one program or one particular policy goal versus another policy goal in a limited resource environment and decide what is the highest priority and the best and wisest use of our funds. And this particular tax credit, this particular time, is bypassing the Ways and Means process. And I sit here and review that the senior and disabled issues that come before the Ways and Means Human Resources that range from in-home caregivers so that people can stay in their home because physically they need to be supported in that home. And they range from...
we have that bill coming in.
Services to a number of things, and the more that we pull off the table at this end of the process, the more we limit the ability that they have at the other end of this hallway to make those decisions and to play off one particular program policy versus another particular, I should say, a solution set. And I cannot support this amendment. It violates, for me, fundamental process we have in this building of determining how we make good policy in an environment where the leadership has made it very clear that we are going to live within our means. And that's fine if that's where you all want to go, but continue to reduce those means. Your left hand and your right hand, I think, are getting... Sorry, I'm dissembling into nonsense here, but I'm pretty frustrated with this bill and this committee at this time when we should have this issue up over in Ways and Means. Thank you.
Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I think this is part of the process that we have here in government, and this is one of the ways in which we make decisions, and we're not making it by ourselves. If this passes, it's got to go to the floor, it's got to go to the Senate, and so on and so forth. And I'd also point out to the committee members that this bill is targeted to help low-income seniors. It's not like we're throwing the money away. We're using it for, if indeed this bill passes, we're using it for a specified targeted purpose. One can disagree as to if that's the most efficient use of those dollars. It's a very legitimate discussion. But to act as if we're just throwing the money away, we're not throwing the money away. We're targeting to low-income seniors. So I'm happy to support this bill and see how it makes its way through the process. But at this point, I certainly support it to keep it alive and keep it moving.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The motion right now is to move it to the floor.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I wish to I move to amend the motion so that we pass this bill through the Ways and Means Committee. And the motion is passed, amend the motion so that it's not to the floor but to the Ways and Means Committee. I believe it has a direct fiscal impact.
We don't, staff, do you have any fiscal impact? There's no fiscal impact on this.
I haven't seen anything.
This is a revenue issue.
Mr. Chair, are we not giving away $9 million of state general funds to backfill the loss to local city and counties?
We're reducing revenues in the 01-03 biennium. That's what this bill does. Okay, Representative Rasmussen has proposed an amendment to the motion to send this bill to Ways and Means. Anybody object to that?
I object, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let's call the roll on the amendment to the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherman?
I guess I'd appreciate a ruling as to whether the motion is in order. I mean, I understand and I support the intent of it, but I know that we don't send revenue bills to Ways and Means. Revenue impact is one thing, fiscal impact is another, and I think without a fiscal impact, my sense would be that the motion may not be in order to send the bill to the Ways and Means Committee.
I agree with you, and that's why I was thinking we'd just go ahead and vote it down, but I don't think we can send bills to Ways and Means just arbitrarily without either a prior reference or without some sort of validated fiscal impact.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think that's especially so, although, again, it's an aspect of the bill that troubles me, the fact that it doesn't have an impact on the current biennium that's being budgeted right now. The part of that troubles me, of course, is it's always easy to give away a tax break. Some other session is going to have to pay for it somewhere.
All right.
I tell you, it'll be a courtesy vote.
Right, and I think also the relating clause relating to taxation takes it out there. So I think, given that discussion, I would rule that the motion is improper and invalid on this particular measure. Any more discussion on the motion? Please call the roll.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. We're voting on the...
Moving the bill to the floor with the due process.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kapori.
No.
Representative Murphy.
No.
Representative Rosenbaum.
No.
Representative Federer.
Yes, as a courtesy to the chair and the sponsor, reserving the right to obviously oppose it on the floor.
Representative Wilt.
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Rick?
Aye.
Ms. Joe Atkinson?
No.
Ms. Robert?
Aye. Bill, House Bill 2792, will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representatives Atkinson and Close, the carriers, and I think there are other people who wanted to sign on to the bill as well. So not sure what the process is for doing that, but I'm sure that is offered.
Okay.
Hey, thank you. Close the work session, House Bill 2792. About a 2-minute recess now. In recess.
Can we get in the building and then we go? I'm supporting this, Jim. Stay home, thanks.
I hate it just as much.
Just want to be,
you know,
why did you hate 34 seconds?